time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday the 17th of September. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 to 12 by Island, the stockist of Waiheke's most eclectic collection of local gifts, art and clothing. You'll find them in Ocean View Road, Oneroa. On Saturday the 17th of December, Sharim Brown talked to Huhana Davis from Piritahi Marae and Hugh Ross, who's recently spent 3 months living in Palestine.
It's lovely to have Faya Huhana, who's at the Marae and also is a teacher at Waiheke High School, and she's very involved with the Marae, and I'd just like to introduce her, and she's going to be talking about going up north. Welcome. Kia ora.
Kia ora. Kia ora Waiheke. Kia ora all the families out there on this very wet and warm Christmas morning.
Kia ora, did you want to do more of a korero?
Yes, I've got a little story to share for us all, and it has particular relevance to this Christmas and optimistically to all Christmases to come. For those that don't know me, I've lived on Waiheke nearly 30 years. My tāne is Eugene Behan Kitto. Between us we have 9 children, and now we have 23 grandchildren. Mokapuna we call that. And when people question me, I say that's for very good reasons. So I'm going to share some of those reasons about the time that is presenting before us. I come from Ngāti Maniapoto, Tainui Waka, and we're here today just to come forward to spread the word to all whānau of Waiheke about the importance of an occasion that we travel north. We travel north to Ngāwha in Ngāpuhi on the 27th of December, 2 days after Christmas. And we return on the 29th of December. We have a bus and everybody is welcome aboard. This important occasion has its ceremonial aspects, which is the unveiling of Korokato Kaufata and his son Joe Kaufata at Ngāwha. But the history of this is what is most particularly important to all of us, and particularly our children. I will just look at history. There was a great chief that came to this island, and his name was Patuoni, and he was from Ngāpuhi. And after his life's work, he was renowned in history as the peacemaker. He lies in Devonport, and Korokato Kaufata is a direct descendant of Patuoni. And he came and lived here out of turf, we could say, because he's of Ngāpuhi, and this is Mana Whenua Tainui land. And he lived out of turf on Waiheke because he loved the people, he loved this island dearly, and he particularly loved the children. And he lived here as our leader, a spiritual leader, chairperson of Piritahi Marae, founding member of many organisations, the sports club, the Buffs, he was part of that, the dirt track, many, many organisations, and I apologise for any that I've missed. And he was a guiding light to all of us and always there for all of us, irrespective of how small the occasion was. He was there as a spiritual guidance, supporter, mate, friend, relation or otherwise to many. So he served this community in that light for over 40 years. So, and in that, his work was in the gardens. He was a man of mahi, of work, and his main crop in the gardens was the kumara. The kumara has a symbol, just like we have Tangaro, god of the sea, Tani Mahuta, god of the forest. The god of the kumara is Rongo Mātani, the god of peace. And that's why we grow the kumara. It is about guardianship of the spirit of the land. And that's what's so important about this occasion, is that through his guardianship, he has handed this taonga, this treasure, on to us, the people of Waiheke. And when we look at tribes, he held that mantle, that rākau, in Ngāpuhi. He brought it here. He's handed it back to Tainui Waka to look after, to be the kaitiaki of. And in all that, that we have grown kumara with him for some 20 years. And in that, we feed the vulnerable, i.e. haora people, budget advice, the full school hangis for matariki at the high schools, any type of fundraiser, the kumara will be present. It is present in that hope that has been handed down, that in the future for our generations, that if we all work for humility in that light of peace, then that's a very real symbol that each and every one of us can grow in our own backyard, and as it grows, we can relay the importance of what that's about. I've always said to our students at high school, irrespective of what may happen in the future, if you could catch a fish in one hand and you had a kumara in the other hand, you have a very good chance at life. Fish has all your protein, kumara has all your nutrients and your fibre, and it is a principle of sustainability. That is what that kai is. It is not just to put in your puku. It is a principle of sustainability that we on Waiheke are blessed to have. So this trip is to go home, to Ngā Whā, to Ngā Puhi Tonu, as the island, as a whole island, and as many of us as possible, to acknowledge Ngā Puhi for all that service to this community, to this land, to this, to our people, to carry the kumara, which we have from last year's crop, stored, ready to go, to take that back and acknowledge Kurukato Kaufata and his whānau. And it is not historical, it is present, and it is future. His mokapuna, Tommy Rōpata, is presently carving our wharenui, kia piritahi, which means together as one, the only marae on Waiheke Island. And when we open the doors and all those many years of carvings are revealed on the day of celebrating that, there will be korokato carved into that house to acknowledge us all once again. So these are the stories that need to be shared, and they need to be permeated amongst our babies, amongst our children, amongst our mokapuna, to uphold and carry forward into the future so they can understand some of the grand thinking of those that have walked this land and leaving a legacy, and a fine legacy, in hope of peace through a symbol of kai, of sustenance for our bodies, for our spirit, for our families. So that's what we're about. I want to read you a little notice just now. And it's going out to everybody, and it says, piritahi ai tato, come together as one, for sharing of karakia, prayer and acknowledgements with all those travelling to Ngā Puhi, to pay homage to Kurukato Kaufata of Ngā Puhi for his many years of dedicated service to our marae, our whānau, our whānui and the wider community of Waiheke. The kaupapa is the unveiling of Kurukato Kaufata and his son Joe Kaufata of Ngā Tirangi, Ngā Puhi Tonu. The date together is Monday the 27th of December. The time is 9 a.m. sharp, because the boat is leaving at 10 a.m. on Monday the 27th. We welcome all aboard. There are spare seats in the bus. There are many, many cars going up. It is a boat fare only, and a koha. A koha is what you wish to give of your heart, and that's just to put down on the marae. The bus is sponsored by the Piritahi Haora and the Piritahi Marae. Any inquiries or wanting for bus reservations, please give me a ring, 9093 372 9093, and there are still a few spare seats. And if there aren't, there'll be some spare seats in the car. We welcome all aboard. It is a time of unity. It is a time of Christmas in its greatest spirit, that of peace, that of sharing a greater sense of whānau, a greater sense of belonging, a time of giving, a time of sharing, a time of coming together as one. Kia piritahi ai tātou. Some of us will be sleeping over the night before in our wharenui, that is the 26th, on Sunday the 26th, to share stories of his lifetime, of our lifetimes, of anything that you want to share before we board that bus and travel to Ngāpuhi. So we will be having that karakia. We hope that everybody, even if you aren't going north, will come along and just join in that on Piritahi Marae as we gather in a circle, hold hands and share good thoughts for all in respect. And we move on. My last few words I want to read to you. They are Korokato's words. They are written in his hand, signed by his name. They sit in the marae. And they go like this. Kia mau ki te pai. Kia ata whai I te tangata. Kia marae. Kia mahi kai hei wawai mō te ata whai. Kā tupu koe, hei tangata, hei tangata, hei tangata. And in English, and we must always understand, hold fast to being good, be kind to people, be hospitable, prepare them food to give legs to kindness, and you will grow in the image and likeness of God. Kia ora mai, Korokato. Thank you for this time. It's very precious for all of us. We look forward to this time, we look forward to the sharing, and once again I encourage one and all, children particularly. His heart was always with our children, as a teacher, as a mother, as a grandmother. They are the most precious on this earth, and this is an emphasis of nurturing humility, because we are all aware that the downfalls of our nation, of our universe, is ego. So the more that we could nurture humility in respect of something very visible, very nutritious, very yummy, very good to grow, all very positive things. So kia koutou katoa te whānau whānau of Waiheke. If you wish to participate in growing kumara, in sharing a lot of love for a great purpose, for a great man, nau mai, haere mai. Welcome. Kia ora mai.
Kia ora. Oh, that was lovely. Okay, well, I guess it's question time then.
Ka poi.
So, ko mātou a kato filled everyone with such joy, whether they were Māori or not. I think everyone, I didn't know him very well, but whenever I saw him, he was always had such a beautiful energy. And so I guess I wanted to ask you, this process of going north, you take the kumara, yes, and you leave it there to be planted, or you help in the planting of it there?
The kumara has been shared with his family who live up north each year. The exchange of kai from the land, or the sea, or wherever you are, is a natural part of kaupapa Māori. So the kumara came from there. But on this occasion, it is like a Māori, a life force of the land here, that has been nurtured and grown here, and in recognition to what he's handed down. And so we take that back, and at the kai hākari, the final day of us together, of course we'll have a hāngi, and that has its own importance of why we cook on ceremonial purposes in respect to cooking in Mother Earth. And the kumara that we carry back will be part of that hāngi, and once again that's about he ringa ngā waka, binding people together, binding the waka together through kai. We talk about things on the marae being tapu and noa, sacred and neutral. Kai is part of that. So we will be carrying it back with other delicious growing kai that Eugene is growing in the gardens. Kato's pumpkins are growing. There's pumpkin seeds. There is a delicacy of a squash, a gem squash from further ancestry that is growing there. So there's a lot of food growing on this island that has a lot of genealogy way back that is grown for purposes such as this. Mm. And it will be carried with us and we will share in that kai. Mm.
And Matua, Eugene has also been helping the grow people to put in kumara, I think. There's quite a lot of initiatives which might be connected around growing kumara around the island, because the high school also grow kumara, don't they?
It was gifted there. Certainly our son graduated from Ngā Purupuru Akoranga, mihi atu ki a koutou Ngā Whaia, Whaia Āwhina, Whaia Jeanette, Whaia Pauline Ma. So our last son, number 9, had graduated from there, and on his graduation day, Eugene and the bilingual unit put over 100 kumara in the bilingual unit garden. So that's how it goes, leaving the legacy for those that, even though we've passed into another school, that the tamariki behind them will learn to care and learn to taste reka maurua. It's Māori name, reka maurua.
So
the everlasting sweetness.
So is kumara, a kumara is kind of like it's different from a seed in that it's a continuously growing thing?
It's not a continuous growing thing, but there's a lot of things, and I don't really want to go into kumara. I know a little bit, but certainly Eugene, being beside Koro Katoa for 18 odd years, and he maintains it takes 3 seasons before you are familiar with it. It is a very kai taonga. It's a very old kai. It has a lot of hohonutanga depth to it. I can tell you this much, it's magical. There are boys and there are girls. There are male and female. They go to bed together. No, it does not just grow from seed. And if you taste that is growing of those that grow in that manner, as opposed to kumara growing in a supermarket, you'll instantly know the difference. Mm. That's all I can say.
Well, that's like food all over, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And Ngāti Hauora, it is called spiritual well-being, from the 4 cornerstones of health, for the hinengaro, the mind, the tinana, the body, the wairua, the spirit, the whānau, gives us our sense of belonging and our social sense of cause.
Wow. So sounds like I didn't realise all of that stuff about the kumara.
Mm.
So, yeah. Mm. I think avocados are like that as well, that they've got males and females.
Mm. I don't know much about those things. I know that we have always had a strong focus of kai Māori, rongo Māori medicinal qualities of the land, and really, at the end of the day, should the supermarket close, we only have to look at the vulnerability of our world. We are an island. We need to self-determine our own safety, our own survival processes. And if we grow guardianship to the spirit of this land and growing kai and recognising properties of our natural environment on how to heal ourselves, then those are some of the greatest elements which will afford survival for our families, for our children, when we need to self-determine our own safety and our own well-being at times that we could be most vulnerable in.
Mm, no, very interesting. Okay, so this trip up north, you're going up on the 27th, and from what I understand, everyone's welcome, whether they're Maori or not Maori or connected to the marae or not.
That's right.
Right. And how long are you going for?
27th, we leave at 10 o'clock in the morning, and so I have said 9 o'clock sharp for the karakias, the prayers, the sharings. And we will be on that bus out of here up north. There is a 5 o'clock porphyry at Ngāwha for all manuwhiri or Wawaitapu, in other words, those that are sacred to that land up there, will need to go through that pōwhiri process, as many of us will. And we will, on the 28th is the day of the unveiling, and then we will rest that night, and 29th we will return first thing in the morning.
Right, okay, lovely.
Just before I go, and in significance to some of the kōrero shared, particularly that in regards to peace, I just wanted to make, and I read this in the latest Gulf News, in regards to the history that's long been set here in optimism and hope for peace and bringing ways, real ways of recognising that is part of human nature that sometimes can be neglected in our busyness and our sometimes unnecessary wants. We live in an area or an age of accumulative greed where we are never satisfied. And particularly at Christmas time, we think of those that are most vulnerable with less. For myself and 23 mokos, I immediately get busy to make things. So just thinking of all of yous out there and saying, kia kaha, kia maia, kia mana wanui, be strong, hold fast, always have great heart. There is hope. There is hope in these things that matter most. If you choose to believe. And certainly a time that is important for many of us is presenting right now this Christmas. However, just if you have a Gulf News, and I acknowledge Gulf News is a great connector of our people, it heads, Peace City Proposal gets go-ahead from Forum. A proposal to widen a declaration for Auckland to be a city for peace has got the go-ahead from a forum of Auckland City Councillors. I'm not going to read the rest, but in reality of what we've been discussing, men of history that laid down those ways in optimism, symbolism within our island that has long been growing here, gifted, acknowledgements that we will participate in, and then before us in regards to future, not only our house to be opened and celebrated as a whole island and a nation, where all tribes will come and acknowledge the first house to be opened, the symbol of peace emanating through that whare, kia piritahi, meaning together as one, for all people of the four winds. And now Auckland City is proposing that our city be a city for peace. So
that can't be a bad thing.
With that, lovely people of Waiheke, it leaves me with a lot of optimism, and I will mauki te whakapuno. I will hold to those beliefs and
now I just wanted to ask you just a couple of things. Which was how long when is the piritahi going to be revealed and the carvings and all of that?
Once again, not a question for me to answer. That would be a Tommy Ropata question, grandson of Korokato. Certainly the process has been 7-8 years. We are nearing completion.
And once the carvings again, are very beautiful. The ones
once
I've seen
again, it's this very, very spiritual mahi in what goes on. And I look back to my marae at Kawhia, and one took 36 years and 6 carvers. So in the light of how things go, dependent on finances, of course, but also it has a principle of kia piritahi, together as one. It was named that by our Queen Te Atai Rangikahu. There will be a time that is appropriate, optimistically, after, put it this way, Korokato could not be carved into our whare if he had not passed on. And so his passing is timely and worthy for the mahi that has been done and the recognition that is about to happen. and that will come back, and in a spiritual content that will nurture the completion of our house.
Mm. Yeah, it's quite lovely the way the marae seems to, the spirit of Kato is kept alive with different events.
Mm.
Now, what other kinds of things have you got planned at the marae for next year? Is there any specific things that are happening?
There will, of course, be Waitangi Day. There will, of course, with the lifting of this kumara that has just been, and I need to share that little story. Kumara is hard work. You've got to bend your back. You've got to get a bit dirty. And this year, we were minimal in the workforce. So we put the call out, the karanga, to the bilingual unit. And the children, 10, 15, would every 2 weeks they have to plant over November, and it must be in by a certain time, otherwise it's too late. So they would come and stay at home. They would be up at 7 in the morning, and they would do the kumara with Eugene. So on average they planted 600 to 800 kumara from 7, 8 till 12 every fortnight for the last month and a half. These are babies aging from 7 to 12. So to you, ngā purapura kōranga, ka mautuehe, awesome mahi. They had a lot of fun. Whenever you're together with children, it is great joy. It is not hard work. And we celebrated in many, many ways. And they will be there to uplift the kumara. They are all booked on the bus to go north, or the different cars. There are a lot of cars going north as well. And they have been practicing their kapa, their haka, and their waiatas to go back during that time, because as you're doing the kumara, you're obviously thinking where it came from, how it got here, and all the stories that need to be passed on in regards to growing the kumara. So to them, great joy, great fun. Merry Christmas, kids. Love you much. And that will be, Eugene has said that when we lift this kumara, there will be a hāngi right in the garden, as was the old days. And that's about when you open the land and the kumara, the hā, which is the steam of Papatūānuku joining with Rangi Nui, Sky Father, as the kai is cooked in the ground. So that will be an occasion that for all those that have been involved, we will have matariki, mid-year celebrations. We are working very much in light to the nearness of completion of the carvings, and the house needs to be put together. The Māori of that is about all of us. Is about all those that live here, all those that have walked this land of Waiheke, that have contributed in any manner towards our collective well-being. And there will be many occasions where optimistically we join together to do with the tuwhera, which is the official opening. It will be a big deal. It will be thousands of people. It will require manaakitanga, hospitality of this island, to uphold the mana of our island in feeding these people, in entertaining them. And optimistically, we as Waiheke Island can come together and support this as a huge occasion of spiritual significance. An acknowledgement to all that effort and mahi and all that have been involved, and the stories of history that will be revealed, and particularly for our children to take forward into the future. So that's what's coming in front of us, not too far away. Can't say the day, don't know the day, but anyone that wants to contribute of their heart towards the goodwill of that is always welcome.
Thank you very much. Now, I just wanted to, one last thing. Are there any specific Māori traditions around Christmas or this time of year that aren't the same as Christian traditions, or is it is Matariki? Is there anything you wanted to say very briefly about that?
The traditions don't change. The kaupapa is what it's about. Manaakitanga is the main kaupapa of any group gathering, and that is the main kaupapa of every marae in New Zealand, and it does not change. Manaakitanga means to cherish and nurture fellow mankind. So whether you're under sorrow or whether you're under happiness, it is the same. In other words, we formally welcome, we share kai, we offer a bed, we never offer a bill. So for Christmas, manaakitanga is that. For nongatanga, building relationships between humanity, irrespective of who comes to your doorway, it's no mai, hora mai. Come in, and there would be a cup of tea on the table. And with our elderly, always the best would come out. So those things that are the philosophy of kaupapa Māori, manaakitanga, cherishing fellow mankind, whanaungatanga, building relationships as family and extended family. Kaitiakitanga is the care of natural resources. In other words, if we are a sea people, we would gather our kina or our pipi, and for our manawhiri, our guests coming, we would have a little to give them to go home. And so when they come to our whare, they will get gem squash from South Africa grown by Eugene. They will get, if they've got a momai, they've got something sore, probably a midi midi, a good massage by Eugene. They might get a cup of tea from me and probably a lot of kōrero. But those are the things.
So Eugene's a good person to have
it's
around.
It's the swapping of what you have. Mm, irrespective of how little, we say the kōrero is ahakohe iti he pounamu. No matter how little it is very precious. And so it's the giving and the sharing, not so much on a materialistic basis, but of heart giving of whatever you've got, and sharing and coming together as one, and karakia, prayer before our kai, prayer for our world, for our people, our families, and celebrating life.
Hmm. Well, kia ora, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us, and safe trip up north.
Yep.
It sounds like a huge adventure.
A wonderful wairua, and to be travelling with all of Waiheke and with many of our elderly, I think of you and acknowledge you, our kaumātua, our kuia. I know my hara mai, you will be well looked after on the bus. And at Ngāwha, certainly our Hauora team is aboard. So if you wish to travel, I just assure you that your personal care will be well regarded. Nō reira te whānau katoa, enough for me. Think about the kaupapa. Miri miri this kaupapa. Midi midi, what's that word? Massage this kaupapa of peace, of kumara. Not for you, not for me, not for them, but for our children and our mokopuna. Merry Christmas to one and all. May it be safe for those travelling, and I look forward to sharing karakia with all of us on the 27th. Kia ora mai tātou, pai marari.
You're listening to Island Life, Waiheke People, Events and Issues, brought to you by Island, Art, Craft, Giftware, Clothing and Bric-a-Brac, Ocean View Road, Oniroa.
So Hugh Ross has come in today. He's just spent 3 months in Palestine, and he's going to be talking to us about his experiences there. Hi, Hugh.
Yeah, good morning, Sharon.
So you need to be a bit closer to the mic. Lovely. And okay, great. So what made you go off to Palestine for 3 months?
Well, I guess on a pragmatic level, I kind of had the opportunity to go away for 4 months. So it's something I've been planning to do or thinking about doing for quite a long time. But of course, the underlying motivation was my fascination and my anger and concern about the situation for the Palestinians in Palestine, and obviously that's the West Bank, and also we know about the situation in Gaza. So I was very keen to see what that was like in, on the front line in real life.
So what is the situation on the West Bank? Because there's been that wall that's been built right around the West Bank, which doesn't exactly follow the lines of the 67 war, but seems to cut out water and strategic territories.
Yeah, well, the situation, I guess, in the West Bank is that since the 2000 Intifada was crushed by Israel, there's been an increasing emphasis since on the expansion and development of settlements. So those settlements pretty much create a stranglehold on the western side of the West Bank. They monopolise water. They monopolise most of the agricultural land, the most fertile land in the west of the West Bank. And the wall has been built to pretty much secure or protect and implement the annexation of the land that those settlements have been developed on. So it's interesting to note that the wall and the settlements that have been built inside what's known as the 67 line or the green line, which is internationally recognised as being the boundaries of Palestine, is in total contravention of the World High Court ruling in 2004, which found the wall and the settlements to be illegal under international law.
So what kinds of things were you doing while you were there? You were in three different communities. What kinds of things were you doing?
Well, firstly, I was working alongside an organisation called International Slow Reality Movement, which is ISM. And they have three apartments, or one in the south in a city called Hebron, one in Ramallah, which is in the centre of the West Bank near Jerusalem, and one in the north. In Nablus, which is close to the Jordan Valley, which is quite a contested area as well. And I think there was a number of different things we were doing depending on where we were geographically. In Hebron, in the south, there's a lot of problems in the city itself with the settlers who attack children, attack the small villages that are in the area, and also the army aren't that helpful either. And often you'll find that, depending on who's the commander of different checkpoints that are scattered through the city, they'll you can have up to 20 or 30 Palestinians being held at checkpoints for 2 or 3 hours at a time. So if there's an international person, then you have the ability to bring in other organisations that can help to alleviate that and bring pressure on those situations to let the flow of people carry through. And I think probably one of the more important things that was happening was in the south is in Hebron area. There's two very very large settlements, Kiryat Arba and Givat Hasina, which Givat Hasina especially has an outpost, which is basically an outpost is probably a small miniature settlement that's kind of populated or occupied by the more radical fringe settlers who have an aggressive ideology in terms of their attitude towards the Arabs. So, for example, there's one small village called Al Buwari that we supported quite a lot. So basically we would be there just as an international presence, sleeping in different houses there in case they were often attacked. So the settlers would come at night and chop down their grapevines or burn their olive trees, stone their houses, and during the day they'd be maybe chasing the children or throwing stones at the children. And these would be typically kind of like Shabab, so kind of 18 to early 20 year old men and women from that outpost. So that's what was happening in Hebron, was basically supporting those little villages from the settler attack and also kind of helping ease situations in the middle of Hebron city itself. But
and what was the role of the military in all of that? Were they keeping the peace, or did it depend on who was on duty, or were they generally not very effective?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It's really hard to make a generalisation on that, but generally you'd probably I'd have to say that the military are really there to protect the settlers. They often aren't there to in any way facilitate law and order for the Palestinians. And so, like, that's why you'd have, like, Christian Peacemaker Team were another organisation working down there, and they were quite involved in the checkpoint watch. So, yeah, I guess the army definitely weren't helping us at all. And, you know, on the subject of the Israeli Defence Forces, I think what's more pertinent or more current is the protests that are happening every Friday. So every Friday along the route of the wall, there's a number of villages that for many years now have been protesting on a Friday, weekly protests. So the villages of like Nilin and Berlin, which have had quite a lot of international coverage, and more recently the village of Nabisala. And what's really disturbing about those situations there is that these villages are protesting non-violently. It's political protest, and they're protesting against the wall, the construction of the wall that's cutting them off from their land. Like in the situation of Berlin, the wall, it's separating them from 70% of their land. And the land is, the wall has been constructed to secure, protect, and reinforce the presence of large illegal settlements. So what you have is a situation where you have an indigenous Palestinian population protesting politically and non-violently against a wall and a settlement that's been declared illegal under international law. And yet what will happen is that the Israeli military will crush those demonstrations weekly with large amounts of tear gas, rubber bullets, sometimes live ammunition. And so, you know, you're asking about what I was doing there, or what international people are doing there. The presence of international people at those weekly protests is a really important deterrent to prevent the level of violence against the Palestinians getting out of control, because we know for a fact that prior to the presence of internationals coming and being involved in with Nilin and Berlin, there were quite a number of fatalities and deaths in the Palestinian people.
So can you give it, I mean, of course, so you went to these protests. What other kinds of actions were you involved in while you were there?
Actions? Well, I guess, so as well as doing the weekly protests, I also spent 3 weeks up in some of the small villages around Nablus, which is in the north. Now, it's kind of like an extension of the whole architecture of occupation that's kind of that's got cast on top of Palestine by the military. And so up there was the olive harvest. And what happens with the olive harvest is we were basically picking olives with the farmers who have the olive groves very, very close proximity to the illegal settlements. And you have to understand that, I mean, there's 200 illegal settlements in the West Bank, in the west of the West Bank, and also in the Jordan Valley. So, I mean, the place is littered with illegal settlements, and so wherever you go, there'll be an illegal settlement somewhere. And if there isn't an illegal settlement, there'll be an outpost, which is, instead of being a settlement, will be a large suburb. It'll have a lot of security fences. It'll have its own water, its own power supply, and it's like a self-contained suburb. Some are medium-sized, some are huge, some are entire cities. An outpost might just be a caravan or two caravans, and the people, the settlers that occupy the outposts, as I was saying before, like in Hebron, they represent what you might call the lunatic fringe of the settler Zionist movement and its occupation. So we would be picking olives with the farmers that were working in very close vicinity to those outposts and those settlements, basically to prevent the settlers coming and attacking the farmers while they were working. And getting back to the question of like how, what role did the military play in these situations, you'd actually have the situation where soldiers, Israeli Defense Force soldiers, would come and throw you out, like make you go away under gunpoint from picking olives. Because, and it's interesting because the even the Israeli High Court has passed a ruling saying that it's illegal for the military to prevent Palestinians picking olives in their own olive groves, unless there's like very, very, very valid one-off security reasons. They just can't have a blanket go away. And yet the military, the army in these areas will totally disregard their own law and will implement total exclusion of farmers from the olive groves. And what happens is that if you don't use your land for 10 years, then it becomes absentee land, and so then it goes back to the state of Israel. And this is just another way that Israel annexes, using violence and using bureaucracy, the land of Palestine.
Now, one of the other things you were talking about was protecting children. What were you doing there?
Well, that was probably a smaller part of what happened in Hebron, because I'd have to say that in the past, the level of violence towards school children from the settlers who've occupied the middle of Hebron has been quite violent. But I think because of increased international outrage over the situation, specifically in Hebron, is that there's quite a number of international organisations. There's the EAPPI. There's the Christian Peacemaker Team, and there's TIFF, which is a temporary international presence in Hebron. All of these organisations are quite dedicated to looking after the children in Hebron. So for us, when ISM, it wasn't so much part of what we did so much. In El Bueri, which is a small village I was talking about earlier, in El Bueri we would coordinate with Christian Peacemaker Team to look after the children coming back from school through the area. Was the problem that they have in El Bueri is that the village is very close to the outpost. I mean, some of the houses, and the houses are quite large, and they often would have like four or five families in a house. Some of these houses are backed right up to the hill called Hill 18, and so they're within stone throw of the tents and caravans that occupy Hill 18, and so these settlers, as I was saying before, probably represent the more lunatic fringe of the settler movement, and those settlers would often be yelling, chasing, throwing stones at the children as they came back from school. And it wasn't even very organised. It seemed more like they just kind of have a random
low-level intimidation.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay, so one of the things that some of the Palestinian organisers have commented on is that they need to be quite creative in their non-violent protests. So what are some of the things that people were doing to sort of not make light of the situation, but to sort of make the protests a little bit creative?
It's hard. I know in Berlin, not when I was there, but I know from reading the history and talking to people that are long-term organisers in Berlin and Berlin, is that they've often had kind of like theme marches where they'll dress up as the characters from Avatar and dress up and, you know, paint themselves blue. And, you know, at Christmas, everyone gets dressed up in Santa Claus. But it's a bit sad because, you know, you'll see a lot of video of like Santa Claus and the elves being tear gassed and maced by the IDF, which isn't such a good look for the young children. I don't know. I mean, I think that if the listeners want to go to www.waiheke.tv, it's a video blog that I help organise. There's some quite a good video there that I shot and edited. And there's one video there called Creative Resistance, and it shows what happens in Nabasala, and it has an interview with a guy called Fadi, who's one of the popular committee from Nabasala, and he talks at length about framing the nonviolent resistance in the same kind of history and the same philosophy as Nelson Mandela and Gandhi.
here with Hugh Ross, who just came back from 3 months in Palestine. So, Hugh, what was it like living in the West Bank? I mean, just from a cultural perspective.
Well, that's, I don't know really how to answer that question. From a cultural perspective, well, you without romanticising it, I have to say that Palestinians are definitely some of the most fantastic people I've ever had the opportunity to meet or to travel with and to work alongside. Really committed. A lot of what really struck me, I know there seems to be some kind of, like, some people have this stereotype that the women are quite oppressed and live at home and have to wear veils, but what I found is that in the front line in Nabasala, where I was actually spent a lot of time with Nabasala, in Silwan, which is an East Jerusalem suburb, which needs to have like a whole kind of book for itself, really. There's actually the woman are spearheading those political movements in those areas, and also in the Jordan Valley as well. So culturally it was, you know, it definitely broke some of those stereotypes that I had. But yeah, just to say again that they were fantastic people, really welcoming.
And what was the food like?
Fantastic. I just lived on falafel and cigarettes. But no, it's falafel and falafel, occasional shawarma.
And pita bread.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay. So.
The one other thing, you know, like about the cultural side of it, one of the things I found really impressive as well was the music. You know, wherever you go, you only ever hear Palestinian music. It's like you won't hear anything from America or Europe, or, you know, it's, they're really proud of their own culture. I mean, if that was the part of your question, I think their pride, and actually went to a couple of festivals, and that was probably another overwhelming impression, was their real pride in their culture and their sense of being quite solid together and politically aware. I mean, it was quite interesting, you know, anyone you talk to had a really large concept of the peace process and the injustices and the rights and wrongs of what was happening, and they can also, not just in their own situation, but they could, you know, they were very, very politically astute in terms of what was happening internationally with, you know, obviously with America and England and the situation with Iraq and Afghanistan.
Mm. Okay, so one thing about the wall is that Stop the Wall, which is a campaigning group, has said that there are 266,000 Palestinians in 78 communities that they think are facing living conditions that will force them to abandon their homes. That would be the equivalent of 1 in 6 Aucklanders. So what are the things that perhaps we could do to send a clear message to the Israeli government that what's going on there is not acceptable? And I have to say, I mean, I don't think Israelis, for the most part, are very happy at living in a siege, in a country that's under siege. So what are the things that we could do?
Yeah, I'll definitely talk about that just in a minute, which is basically what you're referring to is what's known as the BDS campaign, or Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions, which is maybe not such a high profile in New Zealand yet, but internationally the boycotting of settler produce and Israeli produce, and the pressure on financial institutions to extract or to stop investing into, especially companies that are building in the settlements. So there's quite a lot of high-profile companies that are making a lot of money by building settlements, which is a booming industry. And that actually brings me back to something I really want to talk about just very briefly, is the recent peace process, which, as you can imagine, a lot of people are quite cynical about. What's really interesting about the peace process and the narrative there that's being kind of like run out by Obama and Netanyahu is this whole thing about settlement freezes. And it kind of gets back to the idea that the governments of America and Israel, you know, in collusion with the Western media, are framing the context of this discussion in terms of like whether the Israelis should or shouldn't indulge the Palestinians with a settlement freeze. So what they're talking about is kind of settlement building and expansion, Now, this is, I mean, we're talking about settlements. Right now, there's 500,000 settlers and over 200 settlements that are strangling Palestine, and are they are the barrier, like the number one problem or obstacle to peace in Palestine is the settlers and the settlements. And they're totally illegal under international law. The United Nations has requested, obviously, you know, it can't, doesn't have the teeth to go through with that, but you know, Israel has been requested to dismantle the settlements and dismantle the wall. So this whole framing of the peace process and the discussion about settlement expansion or settlement freezes is totally grotesque. You know, if you look at it in terms of international law, they shouldn't even be talking about settlement expansion. They should be talking about a timeline for settlement dismantling. So, yeah, I just wanted to say that loud and clear.
Hmm. Yes, well, I mean, it's difficult to see how a solution is possible in that area. Do you see any possible solution?
Well, I mean, like what you were asking before about how we can, you know, if we choose to bring pressure on if you personally decide that you feel that Israel needs to, you know, make these concessions that are critical to peace, i.e. removing the wall and the removal of the settlers and the settlements. Bringing pressure on them at the moment is being done through the BDS, or the boycott, divestment and sanction. And
What does that stand for? Boycott divestment and sanctions. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, things have made inroads since and the anti-apartheid boycott South African things. We've got a whole range of things there. Okay.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, it's a bit of a menu of possibilities. And on wahiki.tv, there will soon be some connections to international BDS campaigns and also the local BDS campaign.
Okay. I mean, one of the things that people often say here is that, unlike Europe, we don't seem to get a lot of fruit and vegetables from Israel. So what kinds of products would people be avoiding if they were deciding to boycott Israeli things?
Coca-Cola.
Right. Okay. Well, that's always a good one. And I'm sure we could boycott Nestle while we're about it. I'm sure everyone seems to want to boycott them. So, yeah.
I mean, I think definitely with the BDS in New Zealand, you need to choose your battles. And at the moment, there's not really a coordinated BDS movement in New Zealand. So in the next 12 months, that will start to find more traction. Involved at the moment with a few people that are coordinating to give that movement in New Zealand some traction, and that information will be becoming more widely accessible.
Mm. Well, it does seem that sanctions and boycotting is a really powerful tool, especially a non-violent tool, and it certainly proved to be really successful in South Africa. So hopefully it will prove successful to bring people to the negotiating table in this instance.
Yeah, and just on that note, I'd like to say that the village of Berlin, which has had a lot of its protesters, a lot of its political activists arrested under military law and imprisoned, sometimes for up to 15 months without trial, actually hosted a visit from Bishop Tutu, Desmond Tutu, and the elders, which is a group of, you know, older statesmen, international statesmen, who were really, really concerned about the situation in Berlin, and drew some very direct parallels with the struggle in Palestine and the struggle that happened under Nelson Mandela in South Africa.
Mm. Okay, well, Hugh, thanks very much for coming in. Hugh just spent 3 months in Palestine. He was just talking to us about that.
You've been listening to the interviews from last Saturday's Island Life, our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. Island Life is brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, and the interviews are replayed on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock. They're also available as a download from our website www.waihekeradio.org.nz. Island Life is brought to you by Island, the shop with Waiheke's most eclectic collection of local art, craft, giftware, clothing and bric-a-brac. Island, Ocean View Road, Onirola.